Thank you. For those who weren't here last week, remember what we're doing. We're doing redemption history. So we started in Genesis, going all the way through Revelation, and looking at three primary themes: kingdom, covenant, and mission, and then eight secondary themes. And we're looking at it from the perspective of a drama. So there's four acts in the drama, and each one of the acts have various different scenes. The scene we're talking about here is the exile, which, as we said last week, the Exodus and the exile are the two primary major events in the Old Testament that marks off Old Testament history. So the exile is pretty significant. We looked at the difference between tribalism and assimilation. That was our last thought, right? And now Jeremiah predicted the exile would last 70 years. 70 years, that's number six. When Jeremiah 29, when 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will visit you and fulfill to you my promise and bring you back to this place. Jeremiah did not offer precise markers for calculating the beginning or ending of this period. There are two ways to date the 70 years. So there's a specific prophecy of 70 years. And remember, it was that prophecy that Daniel used. Do you remember in the book of Daniel, he read in the writings of Jeremiah about the prophecy that the Israelites would be in exile 70 years. And it was that prophecy he used to begin to intercede and pray. So the markers for the 70 years aren't exactly clear. And there's two different ways. The first calculation, we can do the initial deportation. We said there's three deportations, so three times Babylon comes, and three times they take various different captives. The first one is 605, that's when Daniel's taken, and then 597, remember that's when Ezekiel's taken, and then finally 586. So we could calculate from the initial deportation of 605 until the return of the first wave of the Jews in 538, the first return. Now, that doesn't look like 70 years, but so we're talking about the calculation. So 605 to 538, it doesn't look like 70 years, but that 605 date is flexible. Could be 605, 606. Getting precise dates on ancient events is really challenging because of the nature of the calendars. And, of course, calendars were based on, in those days, were based on the Julian calendar, you know, so that was based on the, it was a lunar calendar based, so there was 360 days in the year, as opposed to a solar calendar, which is 365 and a quarter. And so all sorts of complications in calendars. Interesting thing, in the 1700s, they had been using for so many years the old Julian calendar, and they universally or throughout Europe, they agreed to update their calendar to make it solar, to get all the dates accurate. And so one day, they had lost 12 days since the since the birth of Christ over that period of time because of the difference in the calendars. And so in one day, they changed, and so people lost 12 days. Like one day was October 1st, the next day was October 13th. To try to catch up with the calendar. And there were all kinds of riots. You know, the common people were thinking someone had stole 12 days from them and wanted payment for those 12 days. So any dates, actual day dates before 1750 are all 12 days off because of the change of the calendar. Anyway, studying calendars is a little hobby of mine. I'm sure you're all fascinated by this. Anyway, so it could be 606. And the way they used calculations that day, if it was any part of that year, then you would count it as the year. So in other words, if it happened December 31st and then went till January 1, that would, of the next year, that would be 3 years, even though it's only a year and 2 days. You got that? As far as the way people would calculate. That's why we say Christ was dead and buried 3 days and three nights. But if you do the math from Friday to Sunday morning, certainly not 3 days and three nights, but as long as it encompasses any portion of a particular day, in the Jewish mindset, that was the day. So it was, if anybody ever challenges you on that, that's the answer, according to the way they use the calendar.
What?
Well, what'd you say?
Let me get back to you.
And you never have.
It's like us when we hold the conference.
Hold a conference?
When we hold a conference, we say a 3-day conference, but actually it's only like 2.5 days.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah, right. Now, another way to calculate it, the second calculation could be from the destruction of the temple, which takes place in 586, until the temple is completed in 516. So either way, it doesn't really matter. Now, why was it 70 years? Why was it 70 years? Anyone? Why was Israel, why did they have to go into captivity for 70 years? Why was that the specific amount? 70? 2 Chronicles chapter 36 tells us is to fulfill the years of the Sabbath. So apparently for 490 years, the Israelites had not been observing the Sabbath year. Remember the Sabbath year? So, you know, the whole idea of the Sabbath, right? 6 days you work, and then one you rest. And then there's a Sabbath year, right? 6 years you work, and the seventh year was a whole Sabbath year. So in the seventh year, there was no sowing, there was no plowing. You let the grand land lie fallow. So what God said he would give you in the harvest on the sixth year would be enough to last you 2 full years. So, and then, of course, what would happen is 7 of those would equal the Jubilee year. So 7 times 7, 49. So when you had 7 periods of 7 years, then for 2 years, the ground had to lie fallow. So for the 49th and the 50th year, there was no sowing, there was no planting. And God said on the year before that, he would give you a harvest that would be threefold that would cover those 2 years. So this was the Sabbath plan that God put in. And of course, the purpose of the Sabbath, really, I mean, the Sabbath is really significant in the Old Testament. The purpose of the Sabbath, at least in that sense, is can you trust God? I mean, the same issue with Sabbath today. You know, people who are workaholics, what's the real bottom line is it's based on their works. But God says, if you trust me, you'll get more done 6 days than if you do it in 7 days. 6 days. You know, and some, you know, Chick-fil-A. I don't know, do they have Chick-fil-A here?
No.
Yeah. Do you know Chick-fil-A? It's owned by a really godly man, but I mean, he commits, he does not open his stores on Sunday, which, I mean, everybody thinks that is insane because, I mean, that's one of the major days when families use fast foods and the amount of revenue. But he made a commitment to God when he started that he would give all of his workers, make sure that they would have that Sabbath day off. And so he's never been open on Sunday. Hobby Lobby also is another a major, they don't have them here, I don't think, but it's a major chain throughout the United States. And the guy's a multi-billionaire and a godly man. Actually, his Rice is good friends with him and his son. Been hanging out with him, you know. And that's the kind of things Rice does.
The guy lives in Nashville?
No, I don't think so. I don't know all the details, yeah. I've only seen his son there at the office. Yeah. And Hobby Lobby, they made the same commitment to God when they started. We'll not be open on Sunday. That's a major shopping day. I mean, that's, you know, you go to church and then you go shopping pretty much. And those 2 days, but yet God has blessed them amazingly through that commitment. So that's what the Sabbath year is about. But the Jews, obviously, very early on, you know, think about the faith that would take. To not sow for a whole year. Or, you know, to think about the greed, because the year before you would get the double. Yeah. You know, I got the double, so why live off of that? Why not then plant this year, and then I'll be able to afford that, whatever. So very early on, greed and a lack of trust in God came in. And so in 2 Chronicles, we learned that for 490 years, they did not honor the Sabbath year. And so God said, the land is going to have to lie fallow for 70 years to pay for those 70 years, those 490 years when there was not the Sabbath rest. Yeah, John? 2 Chronicles 36, verse 21. 2 Chronicles 36, 21. You know, that's pretty serious, you know, when you think about how important the Sabbath is to God. And, you know, remember the movie Chariots of Fire? Mm-hmm. So I remember when I first saw that movie, you know, I was pretty excited. It was 1980, and it was pretty exciting that a movie won the Academy Award, Best Picture of the year. And you know, it was pretty exciting to have a major Hollywood picture with a strong Christian message. But I remember being so disappointed that the issue was the Sabbath. I mean, like, that seemed like so lame, you know? Like, just run, dude. I mean, whatever. So I was excited about the movie, but disappointed because it, you know, that it just seemed like, I mean, I would have run, I know, and I couldn't figure that out. It took me a long time. I mean, as I began to see in Scripture the role of the Sabbath in God's mind, and I know in our country, I don't know about here, but I know in our country, the Sabbath was pretty inviolable. Probably by the time that I was born in 56, you know, by that point, especially with I think pro football started, what, 1960, something like that, and they made the decision to play on Sunday. And there's been a major erosion of the whole concept of the Sabbath. Of course, as you know, as our nation's faith in God deteriorated, the whole idea of the Sabbath deteriorated. But, you know, up until that point, it was a serious idea. And it was a day that we set apart for the sake of God and for his worship to honor him. I don't know. I'd like to have some thoughts about that. You know, what do you think the application is in our world here? Is this important? Apparently that throughout church history that the church has thought that the actual day is important. It's not just a spiritualized. Now, of course, the book of Hebrew does put it into a spiritual context. But the church historically always thought that not only was a spiritual manifestation, the rest in Christ, but an actual day. So what are your thoughts about that?
It's challenging because we live in a 24/7 world.
Yeah, you know, I know we do.
And yeah.
So are there any companies in the Philippines that do that, that honor, that you know of?
Not that I know of.
Yeah. Individuals, yeah.
Yeah. Who attend our church. They close on Sundays, but sometimes they'll open for special, like, artists who have shows on a Sunday, so they do that. So it's not always, you know, certain people. You can contact certain people and they open up, but not that I know.
Do you get questions about the Sabbath? They're come up.
Not so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it important?
Yeah, that's why we have Saturday service. You
know? Why? Now, from the very beginning, the church changed the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday for two reasons. Number one, to honor the day of the resurrection. But also, it's a theological idea, you see, because in the Old Covenant, first you work, then you get the reward. But now in the New Covenant, you get the reward first. And out of that reward, then you work. So it's a theological idea. They made a theological statement by changing the Sabbath. Because Old Covenant, work, 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 blessed. So the blessing comes as a result of the works. But now in the New Covenant in Christ, it's a whole theological shift. First, we rest. We receive the blessing. And then from that blessing, we work out of that. we work those 6 days in the refreshment and the blessing that we received. So it's a whole different idea from a legal approach to a gospel approach. So the gospel approach is now in the rest of Christ we work. We don't work to get the reward of the rest in Christ.
Testament, right? The Sabbath is on the seventh day. God rested on the seventh day.
Yeah, yeah.
But now in Christianity, it's changed. Sunday, the first day of the
first
week.
Day of the week, yeah.
So it shifted.
You know, on every calendar, right? Sunday's always the first day. Yes. Go Sunday to Saturday. Yeah, so Sunday's the first day of the week. So in the original, you work, you know, the first day on starts on Sunday. So you'd work on Sunday, work through Friday. And then the Sabbath, of course, the Jewish Sabbath actually begins at sundown, yeah, because that's when the start of the new day, right, from sundown to sundown. So then the church, from earliest records we have, they began to honor the first day of the week. And Paul says, right, in 1 Corinthians, and when you come together on the first day of the week, set aside. So, I mean, that's written 54 AD, so, I mean, little more than 20 years after the resurrection, we already have evidence that the church has changed the Sabbath idea to the first day. And now we get blessed, and in that rest, and we work. I think that's significant.
I thought it was just because of the resurrection.
That's partially, yeah, I think it's both. Yeah, it was the honor of the resurrection, but it's a whole theological statement about what the new covenant is. Yeah, well, in the Old Covenant, the Sabbath had not only a spiritual role, but it had a civil role. So it was a day where the whole nation stopped to honor God. So that's the importance of the day. There was actually a day set aside that the nation honors God. And, you know, we have a thing, we call them blue laws. These are laws that are on the book that haven't been enforced for years. There used to be a whole massive legislation in the U.S. of what you could not do on Sunday. All the things that couldn't be done. We have still have some remnants, like liquor stores cannot be opened on Sunday. That's one of those blue laws that sort of carried over. There's still a lot of laws on the book about what can be done on Sunday, but they're ignored. You know, they don't have any validity. But there was a whole massive legislation of things. It just could not happen on Sunday.
Is that for state or the entire
nation? Most of those were state laws. Yeah, those are. So they were different from state to state, which there would be a preponderance of them in the southern states, fewer in the northern, especially the northwest. You know, that California, they've been reprobate since the beginning, you know.
Would the Amish still be following the... Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they do that. I don't know if they got that much faith.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be, yeah. Yeah. I mean, really, in that, you trust God or you die. Because, you know, you didn't plant, so there's no harvest, so... Yeah, it was a year of family celebrations, of time together, of rejoicing. God's experiencing God's goodness, yeah. Yeah, Noel?
But there's a difficulty of defining what is work. Kind of like what Jesus said.
Yeah.
Like doing good on the Sabbath. Is that work, like for example, do you classify the work of the... doctors and nurses.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's all the laws that develop because, you know, there's a few regulations in Scripture about the Sabbath, but when it becomes legalistic, then you've got to make a rule for every possible exception.
Yeah.
Right? So you weren't allowed to take a journey on the Sabbath day. So then they finally decided what a journey was 18 miles, or the equivalent of about 18 miles. And so then they came up with the idea, okay, a Sabbath day journey is half of that. So you see that reference in the New Testament. You said this was it was about a Sabbath day's journey. Doesn't mean it's about 9 miles. But there was a lot of laws that they developed. So one of the laws that I remember is you were not allowed to eat an egg that a hen laid on the Sabbath. I mean, got that ludicrous, right? Because the hen was working, and so those eggs are off limits. You couldn't eat those. So, you know, legalism can come in really quickly. Yeah, Jonathan? Yeah, well, I think that's been kind of a, you know, that's a basic idea that it goes from the Sabbath that, I don't know any pastor that ever gets a year. But we do that in this, I mean, a lot of our pastors, Ian pastors in the States take sabbaticals. Well, I know I'm going to, as soon as I leave here, I go to Seattle, which I usually do on my way back. And they got two pastors there, Perry and Nick Harang. And Nick will be, when I'm there, he will be in the midst of his 3-month sabbatical. So usually it's some kind of range like that, you know, 2 to 3 months. And I think we have some kind of, in our handbook, some kind of pastors, or maybe this is EN staff, qualify after 10 years, they qualify for a... Yeah.
I remember my brother. He was up in Baguio, and there was a missionary couple there. My brother said they were like on sabbatical for 2 years. And my brother was like,
yeah.
He just in his mind, what are you doing with your life? How can you not? And they're just sitting there, and my brother was wondering. He was asking me about it. Pastors do that? And I said, not that I know.
Not victory pastors.
not victory pastors, but he just didn't, I don't know, I guess, you know, he was a businessman, so for him,
yeah.
You know, I mean, you can understand somebody a month or 2 months, you know, but the guy was just hanging around Baguio, and my brother had no respect for it.
Yeah, you know, yeah. So. No, I understand. 2 years is pretty extreme. It's not uncommon, though, for career missionaries to take that length of time. You know, especially they've gone to a place that's very hard. Yeah. And, you know, it takes a real toll on your family and on your children. So when it's a 2-year one, that probably means there were marital problems that developed. And it's a, you know, it's to see if they can get something restored, probably. Yeah.
And the best greed.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah.
The year of Jubilee includes writing off debts.
Yeah.
It includes providing for aliens. Yeah, it's amazing how. And sometimes the church can argue about the specifics and the law. Is it for now? Is it really then? But it's all over God's dealing with people. It's always to push the challenge.
Yeah. I think that's great, yeah. I think it also puts in perspective work, too. Because you think about, you know, if they followed that, 6 years' work and a full year off, the whole nation. I mean, that, you know, that's pretty astonishing. But I think God says in that what he really values. He values family. He values time, the necessary time together, fellowship, relationship. I mean, they're just, you know, can you imagine if the Filipinos had a year off? I mean, there'd be more parties. They'd just be all parties, wouldn't it? Just party after party after party after fellowship. But what would happen, I mean, what effect would that have in a culture when first of all, the faith it would take to trust God, and then a year to build relationships, to take care of your family, to do the things that you didn't have the time to do. Because during those six years, you work 6 days a week. And Jesus, remember, he said, are there not 12 hours in a day? So a day was 6 to 6. So you're talking about for 6 years, you work 6 72-hour weeks. That's quite a lot of labor. But then you get a full year, and now you're refreshed and you can go back to it. So there's the I did a sermon for Dave Polis before I got here. He's doing a whole series on work. And I did I talked about work and how God puts boundaries on our work. That's what the Sabbath is. It's a boundary to protect us, because we can look to our work for our identity. I mean, that's really, there's the curse on work. There's a curse on, not work isn't cursed, but there is a curse on work. Yeah. Right? That's the important distinction. So, because there was work in the garden, right? So, paradise requires work, which is a completely different concept. You see pictures of paradise. Someone's painting some paradise. It's Boracay, right, or some Filipino island with beautiful white sands and a hammock and a coconut drink. Work doesn't come into paradise, but God's picture of paradise is work. But the fact that he rested, he put a limitation on work. And so then after man's sin, now work is cursed. That means work, what happens is prior to the fall, man worked in partnership with God. So we had a partnership together. We were to, in partnership with him, subdue the earth and fulfill it and replenish it. So we were to take the garden and extend the garden into throughout the entire world as a partner with God. When man sinned, he lost his partner. Now he still feels that same urge. He has to work, because work is the expenditure of creative energy. I mean, he has to create. He has to work. But he's done it without his partner. So now one of the curses on work is we look to work to get our identity. Work is what defines us, as opposed to our relationship with Christ. That's why I use the illustration from the Chariots of Fire. That's what was fresh on my mind. There's two characters in the movie, and it's a contrast between those two characters. So you remember Eric Little. He's got a missionary call to China, but he wants to run in the Olympics. And his sister, do you remember? How many have seen the movie? Yeah. If you haven't seen it, it's a great movie. His sister wants him to run, and he's afraid that he's getting worldly, And he says, I do have a calling to China, and I will go to China. And he did. And God called me to go there, but God also made me fast. And one of the great lines in the movie is, when I run, I feel his pleasure. Yeah, did he? Yeah, yeah. And when he runs not to get an identity. He works not to get an identity. He already has his identity. He runs to honor God. So his work comes out of real rest of the soul. Because you can't get work right if you don't get rest right. So he's got rest right. He's resting in God for his identity. And so now when it comes down to the thing he wants to do, he's blocked to do it because of the Sabbath. Well, it's not a problem to him. Because his identity is not in the race, and he won't compromise. You see, if he looked to his identity in that race, he would have compromised. Well, the Lord doesn't mind, and he would have found a way around it. But because he was really in the rest, his identity came from God, he could turn it down. But then there's Harold Abrams, right? He's the contrast.
Jew.
He is. I didn't bring that up in my sermon, but... But he doesn't have the rest of the soul. He's looking for his accomplishments to define him. So there's the most powerful scene in the whole movie is he's with Sam Massabini, remember, as his trainer. And I think it's an hour before the race. And he said 1 hour before the race. And he said, "When I'll line up on that line, and I'll look down that tiny corridor of 4 yards, and he says, I'll have 10 seconds to justify my existence. But will I?" See, for him, his identity came in his accomplishments. He had no rest of the soul. And so it's a powerful movie about work and rest. And God puts parameters, and that's the thing about the Sabbath. It's the parameter on work so that we don't get our identity from our work, but we get it from our relationship with Christ. And so, we work hard, but thoughts, concluding ideas, anything? What do you do? Sure, yeah.
Where do you work? It's always been ingrained that your identity is with your work.
Yeah. Don't you think there are special challenges for people who are in ministry with that?
Yeah. It's also often that even ministers and Christians come from that perspective. Your work, your identity, you just keep telling them. They hang on verses like you don't work, you don't eat. So.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Go to the ant.
Yes.
Yeah. Proverbs 6.
They say he stores with his season. Not taking the whole context of it, but the ant can only store food when it's summer, because during the rainy season, all the food is washed out. That's why he works tirelessly for us during the summer.
Yeah.
Because when the ground is wet, he can't give him food. But in the Christian
Great.
Stewardship mindset,
yeah.
They keep saying that.
Yeah.
Actually building their identity at work rather than resting.
I think, and there's a pressure, I think, because as a minister, you feel like you're judged by what you've accomplished.
Yes.
And there's always somebody out there who's doing a little bit better than you are, which adds the pressure, I remember when my oldest son was young, he was at Sunday school, and they were doing this little experiment with they had little cups like this with some topsoil, and then it was a seed, right? So everybody got their own little name on the styrofoam cup, and they put their little seed in there, and they'd been talking about the sower, and it was a little illustration thing. So my son at that point, he had a buddy, who the senior pastor's daughter, they were both firstborn, and she was a little bit older, and they were very competitive, as firstborns really are. And so they put their cups were right next to each other on the sill, the window sill there at the church office. And so the first week we came back to Sunday school, and Samuel wanted to see about his, his cup. And we went back, and his, there wasn't any growth in his, but Amy, there was just a tiny little green thing coming up, So he was wondering why she had it and he didn't. And I said, "It's okay, son, it's just the process, it'll be all right." So we came back next week. There's nothing. And she'd got this, it's about like that, And he saw hers and his, and he starts crying, And of course, in his little mind, what's wrong with me? Man, it got to the point I didn't even want to go back to church. I didn't want to break that poor kid's heart, Till finally that glorious Sunday we came to Sunday school and he finally had some growth and eventually, caught up. I thought, that's a profound little example of, he wouldn't have had any problem if it wasn't side by side, right next to that other person. That's what made the challenge, right? Okay, I can trust God. Yeah, I know it's going to come up, but how come he's blessing you more than he's blessing me? I think that, that puts pressure on us, because. We're joking, but there's some truth about that, And we make a joke, after you have to get up after somebody, and you say, "Oh man, who wants to follow him?" But really, that's just the wrong view of the Sabbath, isn't it? and rest and where our identity comes from, not in our accomplishments. And, you know, we have a lot of young ministers who are trying to prove themselves. You know, I've been in ministry 36 years, and I realized a couple years ago that a lot of my ambition, I was really ambitious. I was a hard worker. A lot of my ambition, when I really look back now, was to get somewhere, to be a success. You could say in my career, you know, which was ministry, but a lot of that motivation, a lot of the drive is I want to accomplish, you know, get somewhere. And when my peers or those around me, you know, when they tell me, man, you've done great, a lot of motivation for that. And, you know, there's a lot of that drive that's in us as human beings, and a lot of that drive in our young men looking at you and looking at others and trying to achieve. And we need to help them, yeah, especially as we help ourselves. Yeah, what do you mean? Oh, yeah, like a class reunion? Oh, that's a terrible situation, isn't it? It's, you know, really, it starts in the parking lot in the U.S. In the U.S., it starts in the parking lot. It's the car that you drive up in. That's where it begins. Yeah. And then it starts as soon as you open the passenger side, what your wife looks like. Yeah, that's where it starts, right there. And it's on already. Before you even ask the question, what do you do? It's the car you drive. Oh, he's doing pretty good. He's doing real good for himself. You know? And there's a whole evaluation and pecking order. And certainly a high school reunion has to be one of the most insecure places on the planet. But maybe that's like OPEC, though. Or APEC, huh? Maybe there's a similar kind of, you know, you come to APEC and.
No, in my high school reunion, and when I see them, they're like, what do you do besides work on Sunday? Because they think I just. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What else do you do? What do pastors do? We do quite a lot.
It's not uncommon for men in those reunions to rent cars and to hire an escort. Yeah. So. They're already divorced, yeah. Yeah, so, but they're introducing this is my, yeah, wife or this is my girlfriend, but, you know, I just paid her for the day, so. Any last thoughts about this? The historical exile illustrates a theme that began in the garden and will end in the city of God. Man's first exile was east of Eden, and his final homecoming will be in the new creation. This is the theme, you know, we've talked about this theme of homecoming and exile. We introduced it in the very beginning, and it's an important theme. I think about it a lot because I'm away from home so much. You know, when you're away from home so much, coming home is always such an important event, and then leaving. And also, we went on this vacation just before we came, and I did some preaching also, but one of the highlights, we went to Oxford, and we went to the pub that J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis would meet every week, along with some of the other great writers, Charles Williams and others, the Inklings. And we saw the room that they would meet in, and they would discuss each other's works, you know, and they would, and you know, that was a great place to see and to kind of sit there where Tolkien sat. And yeah, I've been a big fan of Tolkien. You know, I'm in my it's my 22nd time of finishing the trilogy, so I just keep reading it over and over. And fascinating, Tolkien. You know, who C.S. Lewis credits Tolkien as the person who led him to Christ. His example and his testimony. Tolkien was a Roman Catholic. Of course, C.S. Lewis was an atheist when they met, but then became Church of England Anglican. And Tolkien, when he when he started, when he first wrote the trilogy, I mean his first draft, his whole goal was, you know, his main job, he was a philologist, so he's a linguist, and he was always fascinated with languages. And so language is always a product of culture. So he really started it for two reasons. Number one, as sort of an academic exercise to create a massive culture by which he could create all these languages. But then also, because he considered himself a storyteller, he wanted to try his hand at a really long story to see what he could do. But then he said in his memoirs, he said that when he went back after he'd written the first draft, he realized that there were many Christian metaphors, symbols, examples, many Christian ideas that were actually in the writing that in his initial writing he hadn't intended to put there. He was just writing. But, you know, as a Christian, he was writing, and he saw those things had actually come into the writing, not deliberately. That's why he hated Lewis's work. He hated the Chronicles of Narnia and the Space Trilogy, because Lewis, on the other hand, deliberately set about to put Christian themes in. And Tolkien didn't like that. He thought that was artificial. But he said then, when he went back to rewrite, then some of those themes that he'd seen in there, he sort of developed them a little bit more. And one of the primary themes is this idea of exile and homecoming. It's a main theme in the books. You know, if you've just seen the movies, you don't know what I'm talking about. But if you've read the book, you do. The elves, and in Tolkien's mythology, the elves are the spiritual beings. So they sort of represent a spiritual life. And they're always in contrast with the dwarves, because the dwarves are just about, they're just about gold, right? They're just greedy. They're the people of this world. Whereas the elves, they're you know, a little bit more, they're spiritually minded. But they're in exile. You know, they're in Middle Earth because they've been kicked out of the Undying Lands, which is across in the West, and they live here in exile. When they decide, they can cross over, but they can never come back to Middle Earth. And even though the Undying Lands, where they came from, is so much more beautiful and glorious, they've been in Middle Earth so long, they don't want to leave. That's a great picture, really, of a Christian who, I mean, we think about heaven is better than this, right? And yet, none of us want to go, right? That's the elves, you know, they linger, they keep lingering because there's something more to do. But eventually, and there's a prophecy when Galadriel first meets Legolas, he said, "Beware the gulls when you hear the seagulls." Because when you hear the seagulls and the call of home. And after that, so Legolas hears the seagulls, and after that, he's never content in Middle Earth because he's heard the call of that homecoming and the longing for home, which is built into the trilogy. And I was just kind of on the same topic. I was listening to the Led Zeppelin song Stairway to Heaven the other day. Classic rock, you know, most lists, it's listed at least in the top three, but often number one is the greatest rock song in the history of rock music. And Led Zeppelin, you know, Robert Plant and I just forgot the guitar guy's name, but they were fascinated by Tolkien. A lot of Tolkien mythology, a lot of Tolkien writings come into their songs. And so there's a line in Stairway to Heaven. Do you remember the song?
Yeah.
Said, "There's a feeling I get when I look to the west and my spirit is longing for leaving." That's taken really straight from Tolkien. And that's this whole idea of homecoming and exile. You know, when we think we don't want to go, but there's a longing inside. And I turned 59 last week, you know, and each year that longing to go home gets stronger and stronger. And that's that whole theme, it's this recurring theme. You know, we're here, but it's not really our home. We're in exile. And we, you know, like the Israelites in exile in Babylon, they were to work. You know, I mean, they would become resident aliens. Don't assimilate, because you're really a part of another world. But do your best with that particular world. We see this theme all the way through the book of Hebrews. First of all, about Abraham. What was he looking for? He was looking for a city. Yeah, a city. And then in the last chapter, chapter 13, it says, we have here no lasting city, but we're looking for the city that's to come. That's his longing for home. As we're in exile, we don't quite fit here. It's like we do fit, but then we don't quite fit. There's another world that we fit in, and we're longing for that world. Anyway, that's all we need to talk about. That clock is really fast, but let's use that as our official clock, okay? Can we take a 15-minute break? I got to talk all day, and I need a little longer break. So 10:15, we'll start back again.